A million years is a long time. A million years ago, mankind did not yet exist, and yet, we can still contemplate the same timescale for an interstellar mission in our future. So today we return to the Generation Ship series for our fourth episode. In the first, we looked at the basic concept and its history. In the second, Exodus Fleet, we looked at more of the physics of building, moving, and powering these ships. And in the third episode, Exporting Earth, we got some idea how big these ships need to be in order to move viable ecosystems to new worlds on centuries-long voyages. Today, we'll be focusing more on how you keep such a colony ship or fleet maintained that whole time, particularly in regard to the civilization on it, the social drift involved, and if we could realistically keep a ship going for vast amounts of time, potentially a million years. It does no good to keep a ship running for many centuries if the people have forgotten what the mission is, or to keep them focused on that goal only to have the ship simply break or run out of resources before they arrive. A million years is an eye blink in astronomical terms, but it's a near eternity in human terms. It's about how long humanity has been around, depending on how you define human, but it's a couple hundred times longer than our entire recorded history. Even a century is a long time for a civilization, as not many last more than a few centuries, and even if they do, they'll change radically. This episode will come out on October 11th, 2018. A month from now, on November 11th, it will be the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. That's a time that's similar enough that most of us could still function in our homelands of that era, speak the language and navigate the social mores, etc. Yet it's a very different world, with different priorities, and not just because of technology. The 20th century probably had the most dramatic changes of any of its predecessors, but every culture changes a lot from one century to the next, something that can get missed when we read quick surveys of history. That said, human culture does tend to pivot around basic biological imperatives. A culture can get very far away from the norm, but generally it does stay mostly leashed to a general area. I'd be hesitant to say a culture can drift far off that basic biological norm, particularly since we can't really pinpoint what that is, but it would tend to seem the more numerous and spread out a culture is, the less it will tend to drift far away from the median, and the longer it takes to do it. One thing we've seen throughout the series is that generation ships tend to do better the bigger they are, and this is just one more reason to think bigger is better. Alternatively, technology we have now, or close on the horizon, eliminates a lot of the needs for bigger populations, as we saw last time when discussing the biological and ecological aspects of generation ships. The need for large populations has to do with social continuity, something not unique to humans and not genetics itself, as we can circumvent or fix that problem with frozen or digital DNA and gene therapy. Even on a million-year journey, far longer than anything can last even frozen, that digital option of having DNA encoded and being able to print it, tech we already have, even if it's still in its infancy, ensures no generation ship would have genetic issues. Of course, that's assuming they keep their technology, and that's a popular theme in fiction for colony ships and colonies themselves, that they lose their tech during the flight. We see examples in works like Robert Heinlein's Orphans in the Sky and Gene Wolfe's Book of the Long Sun. In the former, they essentially are maintaining the ship with a cargo cult mentality. They don't really get science and technology, they just have rituals for it, very akin to the Adeptus Mechanicus of Warhammer 40,000. There's a certain legitimacy to this too. A generation ship, even a pretty big one, is still one lacking a very large population. If we scooped up the population of a medieval city of maybe 10,000 and dumped them into a full-size O'Neill cylinder, they are very unlikely to ever develop modern technology. There's no coal or oil, and at a few hundred square miles of living area, that drum has a carrying capacity of maybe 30,000 people using medieval farming technology. It's hard to imagine them making much technological progress. If they fell back to being hunter-gatherer tribes, they could support only a few hundred people. So you do not want to lose your technology on a trip like this, because if you do, you're never getting it back, even ignoring that the ship probably needs maintenance and will fall apart otherwise. It's also very unlikely to happen. Common sense says a ship maintained by a bunch of modern scientists and engineers is going to fare better than one run by medieval peasants trained to perform ritualized tasks, so you wouldn't do it intentionally. We already memorize a lot of stuff like startup or maintenance procedures for this or that piece of equipment. You don't need to invent a religion or culture devoted to that. One might tend to emerge naturally with time. We tend to incorporate our priorities and goals into our belief systems, spiritual or secular, and indeed we often develop subcultures around specific fields or professions. But that doesn't imply forgetting our science or history. Consider, any given maintenance or production aspect of a ship that's important will tend to draw folks to it who value that. When a leader is getting selected for that group, it's going to be based on some combination of competence in the field, at skilled administration of the work, and at being a good spokesperson. None of those qualities would tend to result in a mindset that wanted to change it from an effort at true understanding to ritualized performance of duties. Let's also not ignore that there's likely to be some competition for positions or shifting to other duties, both of which encourage folks to try to be good at what they do and cross-train to other skills, neither of which would encourage memorization over true understanding. Now, over time, duties could still develop into ritualized tasks. One could imagine positions being passed on as hereditary offices. That tends to happen a lot with skill trades traditionally because dad is a blacksmith and his son grew up helping out in the shop and is pretty good at it. If you get raised doing something, you are typically better at it than another random person who started later. But there will be other folks with a deep passion and talent for it too. If a system is working well, an awful lot of folks in the field will be second generation, having picked up a passion and talent for a field while growing up surrounded by it, but most won't be. Other folks will acquire a passion for it and apprentice in it, while many kids will want to grow up and do something else. That's the problem with hereditary succession. Not everyone is going to have the passion or talent their parent had, but if they do it anyway, they are just good enough at it that more skilled folks are bypassed, nepotism creeps into the whole system, and actual incompetence sneak into important positions. And the system can go entirely hereditary if a trade guild keeps its knowledge secretive to protect their interests and rarely permit new folks in. Those processes take generations, but this is a generation ship. One advantage we have here is that those colonists are probably supplementing their gene pool with frozen or digital stock, so you'd expect a lot of kids would not be genetically related to one or more of their parents, which would probably discourage a focus on hereditary privilege. Though note that I said supplementing, you likely only need a gene pool of a few hundred people breeding normally to keep things healthy so long as a decent minority of kids were getting born from frozen stock. They also are probably pretty good at genetics and automation. This has some major consequences. First, they likely are longer lived than you or I, meaning decay is likely to be much slower. Even just having most people live the natural human lifespan like we have now has a pretty big impact on our culture. And if folks routinely live over a century, potentially much longer, but we'll save that for another day, they should be much better at retaining knowledge and skills and the original mission intent, more than just proportionally to their lifespan increase too. They probably do have access to fairly sophisticated gene therapy as well, which again is handy for avoiding genetic problems, but also means they probably can tweak their kids to be smarter or healthier on average. Add to that, they are good at automation. The existence of a giant generation ship tends to indicate that in the first place. You can't realistically build such things without a lot of automation. This means they don't have many tasks people can do better through a ritual than thinking about it, because those are the first and easiest things to automate. The colonists aren't working in a factory recycling and reforging new bits of hull plating. They are working on the robots who do that, or the robots who do the robot maintenance. They are still vulnerable to rote memorization over understanding, since any standard piece of equipment is going to have a lot of maintenance issues where a memorized diagnostic and maintenance procedure will be outlined, But again, having those doesn't mean you lack understanding of what's going on, just that you don't have to think much to do it. When I was in the Army, I spent a lot of time fixing, maintaining, and instructing people on various weapons and equipment. All three of those tended to involve a lot of memorizing, but they are also great ways to learn. Taking something apart and fixing it, or teaching someone how to use it, are two of the best ways to learn yourself. And in doing so, I went from fairly mediocre at marksmanship and maintenance to being a sharpshooter and skilled gunsmith. Somewhat atypical skills for a scientist, admittedly. But we all have those extra skills, especially nowadays when technology means we have more free time each day, access to all of human knowledge, and a longer average lifespan to pursue that knowledge. I'd have problems imagining us turning into cretins. Cultures change on unpredictable lines, but background influences matter. If you pick the 100 or so cultures that have existed and that most valued knowledge and learning, the overwhelming majority of them would be around right now. This would not seem like a bizarre coincidence. That would be even more noticeable if we specifically limited it to technical and scientific knowledge. Again, cultures place an emphasis on what's important to them. I could imagine a ship on a very long journey losing its focus on the eventual colony effort. I can't see them losing interest in maintaining the ship they are living on. We can't rule it out entirely, but it seems unlikely even on a very long trip. However, forgetting how to terraform a planet is another story. Now, if they've kept their interest in science and technology, they presumably kept their colonization skills recorded, and should be able to train those back up fairly quickly. And their real limit is the unavoidable one that they had when they left. None of them had ever done it before. However, you probably do have plenty of colonies already. We should never have to employ true generation ships to reach the nearest stars. It might take a century or two for a ship to reach the 100 or so nearest solar systems, and that means there are generations going on, but not so long that you'd expect them to lose their technology or mission goal. And they'd be getting constant updates from each other about other missions that had arrived and were busy terraforming. After that, every ship would have endless updates and progress reports and papers about terraforming to draw on from prior missions. You colonize closest first, so folks leaving for more distant missions will be passing by already established colonies on the way out from which to draw tips. Indeed, they generally have systems nearby them who were a generation or two ahead on the task. They don't have to phone home all the way back to Earth for help. Indeed, since new colonies are likely to have kept their spaceflight capacity, you might easily be joined, near the end of your trip, by a passenger ship full of eager experts who have gotten bored with their work on their own system a dozen light years back and are racing to join you to ply their trade on a virgin world. A passenger ship doesn't need to be very big or redundant if it's just chasing to rendezvous with a fleet still cruising to its destination, particularly if they can freeze their passengers, something we'll talk about next time. But it's important to note that while you are, on the one hand, all alone in the empty night, potentially hundreds or thousands of light years from home, all but the last generations of travelers on a colony ship may be moving through space where other colonies already exist. You can't rely on them for much physical aid, as they'd still be years of delay for them to even know of a problem, and many more to get something to rendezvous with you. But they are providing a constant background hum of aid, well wishes, knowledge, culture, etc. Things differ a bit if the mission isn't colonization, or if your colony was intentionally aiming for isolation and picked a board far from the frontier. A fairly likely scenario, and one which amusingly means the expanding sphere of main colonization might bump into strange colonies hiding on the fringe, particularly since an isolationist group likely already is more prone to many of the behaviors that might cause certain aspects of their culture to drift quickly from the human norm, so they might be quite alien. But drifting off the original mission could happen fairly quickly, even if it doesn't involve them losing their knowledge. A common concern is that the second generation of colonists didn't pick the mission. They were born on it and are stuck with it and might resent that. Let's not even say might, many will. It doesn't have to be rational. People gripe about things without good logical basis for them all the time, but it is a legitimate complaint. I didn't pick where I was born, none of us did, and we don't tend to resent that. But I can leave, and people often do, get out of this podunk town when I grow up. Even if they don't, the option was there as a release valve. Folks on a generation ship cannot and do not have that release valve. This is one reason I tend to expect a preference for a colony fleet rather than a single ship, and for habitation on those ships to still break up into groups. Better a dozen medium-sized ships than one large one. We already discussed the advantages of that in Exodus Fleet for redundancy, but here we see a social advantage. You could have a fleet, all close together while cruising so folks could shuttle or even tether back and forth, and each with redundant components but some specialization. Never anything that would cripple the mission if that ship blew up. But you might have Hull Town on one ship, where they gather worn down and eroded ship plating and recycle it to make new ones for every ship. Each ship might have an engine borg, where the focus was on maintaining the power plant and ship drive, and an eco-town, devoted to providing food and overseeing the flora and fauna they couldn't freeze for the trip. This gives everyone a place to go if they want to leave their community or get ostracized, gives them a sense of independence from each other that would act as a check on any changes. It's easier to seize power in a city of 10,000 on one ship and try to implement a course correction to a new world than to seize power in 100 villages of 100 scattered across 10 ships. This doesn't mean that if the mission is long enough, you can't have this breakdown in science and technology. Engine Borg might go from being dominated by engineers who work on the power plant to engine seers who oversee the holy temple of the sun god, given thousands of years to do so. However, you still have one on each ship, and likely not all would go the same way and act as a brake on each other drifting, and moreover, drifting in ways that didn't work well, since there's likely to be at least some competition in such situations. If two ships in a colonial fleet are in competition or conflict over their approach to maintaining engines, the one using the method that works better is generally going to win in the long term. Also, the more technology and science you have, the harder it is to lose, to a certain point, since it enhances things that make learning easier and more necessary. You need technicians to fix the robots. Those robots give you a lot of free time to think, and so on. At a certain point, this could break down, though. A ship that is automated enough might actually be a hindrance, particularly if it can maintain itself and the humans on board are simply passengers, like the animals, not crew. I was joking about ritually applying holy oil to machines a bit ago, and I imagine many of you caught that as a reference to the Mechanicum of Warhammer 40K. And one of their notions is that every machine has a spirit in it, some fragment of the machine god, their literal deus ex machina, that they worship. That fictional setting is full of contradicting canon, but a thing a lot of folks miss about it is that it isn't meant to be taken as necessarily them being stupid and non-scientific, though it depends on the author of any given book or game in the setting. Beyond that, their universe is full of weird warp entities that tend to possess people or machines anyway. They had a huge robot rebellion way back, and tons of viruses unleashed then, or in any of the virtually endless wars 40K is known for. A popular fan theory, at least some of the writers seem to subscribe to as well, is that virtually every piece of technology they have has some computers in it, and they were all infected with various artificial intelligences of various levels of quirkiness and insanity. So the tech priests of the Mechanicum might actually have to genuinely appease the machine spirit of a device, and probably unsurprisingly, appeasement methods would tend to correlate strongly to proper maintenance methods too. If your car has a personality, odds are good that changing the oil regularly would be one of those things that you need to do to keep it happy and not deciding to suddenly stop working because it feels abused. It's a crazy and contradictory setting, which is generally worse about keeping the science in their science fiction than Star Wars is. But much like satires like Futurama or Rick and Morty, they often manage to hit some bullseyes. A term I sometimes borrow when thinking about maintenance of various space habitats and megastructures is genus loci, the Roman concept of a protective spirit of a place. It would be very easy for me to imagine virtually every space habitat having an artificial intelligence that existed to maintain it, given a lot of intelligence to handle unpredicted events or sabotage too. It would also be very easy to imagine such a thing mutating down the years until it thought of itself as essentially the protective spirit of such a place, and might even branch out how it did that protecting, like hitting someone with a lightning bolt if they misbehaved. It would also be easy to imagine almost every device intended for self-maintenance to have a limited intelligence and personality. This brings up a problem. People might forget a lot of knowledge if they themselves don't have to practice it, because the ship maintains itself and its mission, and rapidly takes a backwards approach to Arthur C. Clarke's famous quote that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. They might forget stuff as they replaced it with close parallel rituals meant to keep those devices happy and working. This also brings up another disturbing issue. I can make a smart machine with a specific set of priorities it will stick to, and which can exist indefinitely. There's concerns about it going rogue or mutating, but probably on far longer timelines than a human culture. A problem with smart people is that they are actually more dangerous than dumb ones, especially to large systems with lots of redundancy that can't survive someone just smashing them with a blunt object. In fact, some crew member going nuts is one of the reasons bigger crews are better. One person going axe crazy from isolation in a crew of six is a much bigger threat to the ship than one person in 100,000. Note how we keep converging to bigger is better for colony ships. So you might willingly dumb folks down for these voyages. You might rely on the genus loci of the ship to command and train them when they approach their destination, similar to the seed ship notion we'll discuss a few episodes down the line, where an AI ship arrives and grows and raises all of its colonists, but more modest. You might steal a page from Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, where Harry Seldon predicts the future and guides humanity after he's dead by having holograms of himself pop up to explain what's going on and nudge them on the right path. You also might take the Pac-Man ship approach we discussed a couple episodes back, where you litter the ship's course with new raw materials and include redundant copies of knowledge databases and mission profiles. More on that in a moment. While we were brainstorming for this episode, we thought of tons of ways to keep the knowledge around or revive it, both the technical knowledge and mission goals, but most had new problems they introduced too. Many could be used in combination to work better, others could not. One thing they all had in common is that they were very manipulative. We launch people, and whether that first generation was in on it or not, every future generation at least was essentially a pawn being manipulated by a dead hand. This strikes me as both very unethical and a poor strategy too. I don't want someone dead 1,000 years trying to tell me what to do, not just because I'm my own person, but because I'm on the scene in the present with a better knowledge of the situation. I don't have to be as wise as they to come up with an equal or better solution, because I know the problem at hand better and what tools I have to deal with it. But I probably am wiser in that regard because I live now, and have had all those centuries of other people since then who have been learning and solving problems. Moreover, and it's a personal attitude that I think helps me keep more positive about the future in general, it's not just that I think we do get wiser as a civilization with time, it's that I don't actually care what happens to our descendants if they don't. I expect them to solve their own problems as well as we could if we were resurrected in their time to deal with them, and if they can't, then that's on them. So for colony ships, my attitude is to give them a mission in mind, and the tools, resources, and flexibility to accomplish it, knowing that it probably won't be exactly what I had in mind, but where it diverges from that, it's more likely to be in a good way than a bad way, on the whole. Of course, that's another reason I don't think of single ships, but fleets of them for each system to be colonized, and millions of those fleets. In that context, with you simply expanding as a vast sphere, you can afford some failures, and nobody is truly isolated. Of course, this was all the social preservation aspect. The mechanical side is either much easier or much harder. There are some things we could build that would keep functioning for thousands or even millions of years, especially in the vacuum of space, where so long as they are shielded from radiation, they have little to erode them. However, complexity is not your friend in cases like this, nor is compactness. A mountain can last eons and still be a mountain, whereas a modern computer will cease being a computer pretty much in mere years. Also, while we might be able to design a ship that can keep its crew on ice and just plow through the void without much maintenance, Humans tend to accelerate decay around them, as does biology in general. And as we mentioned back in the first episode, you can only freeze people for a few thousand years before the radioisotopes in their own body will kill them. This means your ideal strategy is to go for maintenance, not endurance. And that means you need to be able to replace every single component of that ship. This is handy, as it means you can manufacture at your destination too, making all the colonial gear you need, and even making new ships if needed. But it means you need to have that manufacturing capacity on the ship, know how to use it, and be very good at recycling. You also need to keep stockpiles of reserve raw materials around. You will be losing some with even the best recycling, and whatever you are using for power will be slowly depleted. That will likely need to be atomic, be it fusion or fission, or even passive decay. But such materials are energy dense enough to allow you to power a ship for millions of years. A thing to remember too, some materials have half-lives short enough that a million years might deplete them. So you will be losing mass to various factors no matter what you do, and that loss can stack up. Just as an example, a ship that lost 1% of its mass to outgassing or lost parts every century, a very high rate of efficiency, would arrive just fine at a nearby star a century away. One on a voyage of 1,000 years would have lost just under 10% of its mass. It will be down to 37% of its mass in 10,000 years, and will be down to just 0.0043% of its mass in 100,000 years. In a million, even a ship that started off the size of a mountain would be down to a single atom. So you need to do way better than 1% loss a century with an effective ship half-life of 7,000 years, or you need to be able to pick up material along the way. For the first, we have some examples, and again, bigger is better. Earth is a spaceship, and one working fine after 4 billion years of travel. We do lose material, but far slower than 1% a century. The bigger your ships are, the easier it is to prevent losing mass. You can have thicker ship hulls, even multi-layer hulls, that leak less, and little cracks or losses to an airlock are proportionally much smaller. Build big enough, and you'd actually retain some material by gravity, but you have to get very big for that, and we'll discuss planet ships another time. Now, to gather material along the way, you either have to stop fairly often, or be keeping to speeds that allow you to profitably gather materials. That start and stop method is something we'll discuss more later too, in Gardner ships, since it would tend to make sense to stop for a while and set up a colony, then move on and do it again. We also have the Pac-Man approach, where pods are sent at fairly similar speeds, so the ship need not slow to gather those resources. As to grabbing resources as you go, this all has to do with your internal power plant. If you're flicking along at 2 or 3% of light speed on a fusion engine, you can probably absorb interstellar gas as you go and refine it for fusion fuel and heavier elements. But if you're going much faster, trying to suck that matter in is going to result in slowing you down by more than the energy in that fuel is worth. If you run on uranium or thorium, much rarer than hydrogen and much lower in energy density than fusion, you'll have to go even slower. Alternatively, if you've got matter to energy conversion, or a black hole drive, something we'll also discuss more later in the series, you can probably achieve a cruising speed of more like half of light speed. You will have a break-even point for any drive, where if you go any faster, you'll slow down more than the fuel you are running into can speed you back up. This break-even point becomes your cruising speed. But the void of space isn't a complete void. There's gas and dust. And it isn't just hydrogen and helium, so you could resupply this way. It's not as cool as a Bussard ramjet, which was proposed to let you indefinitely accelerate this way, but it should be viable, whereas the Bussard ramjet isn't. It's an interesting ship design paradigm shift too. We always picture spaceships, especially interstellar ones, as long and narrow, to cut down on collisions and drag from those gases and dust. But if you're collecting them, you'd want to be wide. And for many of our designs that rely on long-distance laser propulsion, you also want to be wide. We usually assume extending a cheap thin sail or collector for those ends, or even just a magnetic field. But it does give you an excuse to make ships that aren't shaped like needles or arrows. And it's not just gas and dust out there. It accumulates into small clumps, and you could possibly send a smaller ship to harvest that and then catch back up. It still has to pay the energy bill to slow down and speed back up, but it might be able to cheat. A collector ship could stop on a small rogue planet you spotted, burning a lot of fuel to do that, and collect much of it but leave much behind, building a big laser powered by materials on that mined out object to push it back up to speed so it can catch back up and just decelerate a little so it doesn't overrun the fleet. This would be very handy on long-term missions, particularly those far from any other place, since they could set those up as communication relays back home, and which follow-up missions could also use. Where that's not an option, which should never be the case, except maybe in the intergalactic void or between the spiral arms of our galaxy, you could send pods of material out ahead of a ship for it to catch up to, or behind it but moving a little faster. A big slab of iron should handle eons of travel through the void just fine, and comets prove volatiles like water or ammonia can last a long time too. Again, bigger is better though, and we shouldn't think of a journey of a million years as only intergalactic. 5% of light speed is fairly realistic and even high speed for a generation ship, and for such a speed, even a journey of 20,000 light years across a piece of the galaxy could take a million years. There's other reasons bigger is better, and that is that bigger things are generally harder to break. Also, bigger populations tend to innovate a lot more than smaller ones, and tend to be more resilient too. A small crew is unlikely to provide much in the way of innovation, and something relatively small could wipe them out, whereas a bigger population in a bigger ship could do a lot more on that front. In the cold void of space or in alien systems, the need for innovation might be the difference between survival and total destruction. So while it's harder to produce a large ship that could accommodate hundreds of thousands or millions of inhabitants, it's probably the way that a successful mission would have to go. If we accept that we need a large population to innovate, to deal with the unexpected or downright weird, we also have to expect that change is inevitable. We often say that a battle plan never survives the first skirmish, and we are dealing with a war of humankind versus the radiation-soaked cold vacuum of space that is out to get us. A war that will last for longer than we have been around in our current form as humans. Trying to maintain a ship for thousands of generations is more about trying to maintain the civilization on it than the ship, though that will be no easy feat either. However, by techniques like we discussed today, it may be possible to create a generation ship able to last almost indefinitely and stay on mission, an arc of a million years. For a civilization to thrive on a generation ship, it's going to have to emphasize retaining its knowledge and skills. For it to retain its knowledge and skills, it has to value them and show how they are useful and applicable to the people on board the ship then, not far in the future at their eventual destination. But this is true of the here and now, too. We focus on skills that are applicable here and now, and while we place a value on knowledge for its own sake, that grows out of coming to love a field as we come to see how useful and enjoyable it is. I mentioned last time that showing how knowledge is applicable to problems was one of the pillars of education for our sponsor, Brilliant. And another of those, as we've seen today, is that it needs to be community-driven. If a community doesn't value knowledge and learning, it can wilt away. But if it does, it can inspire people to learn, and they can learn alongside friends and peers. However, some knowledge is less immediately useful, be it nowadays or on a colony ship far from its destination. And to make sure folks are learning those, that knowledge needs to be exciting and cultivate curiosity. We try to do that here at SFIA, and so does Brilliant. To truly learn math and science, to be able to master it like the folks on a generation ship will need to, you need a community and environment focused on enhancing all curiosity and showing how exciting and applicable such knowledge can be. If you want to increase your own skills and understanding, you can go to brilliant.org/IsaacArthur and sign up for free. And also, the first 200 people that go to that link will get 20% off the annual premium subscription. We've explored a lot about generation ships in recent episodes, and have more yet to come in the series, but next time we'll look at an alternative approach, the idea of freezing everyone to be awoken at arrival in sleeper ships. Before we get there, we'll be returning to our new Earth 2.0 series to continue our look at living in the seas, with colonizing the oceans, and see some of the amazing habitats and cities we might be able to make on the seafloor. We'll also take a look at our book of the month, Jules Verne's classic novel, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. 2 weeks from now, we'll be exploring more on the ecosystems and landscapes we expect to find on various rotating habitats we discuss here, like on our generation ships or other megastructures. For alerts when those episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel and hit the notifications bell. And if you enjoyed this episode, please hit the like button and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching and have a great week.